The Conservative Political Action Conference starts today, and while the convention brings together big names from the right, including former President Donald Trump, it's missing a behemoth of influence, commentator Rush Limbaugh. He died earlier this month after decades on the air, and his legacy remains. You're listening to The Morning Show. I'm Keeley Boltina in for Kate Archer Kent. We're talking about what Limbaugh did for, with, and to politics. And we want to hear from you. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. What do you think of the influence that Rush Limbaugh had on the GOP and our country? Do you see it today? Do you think anyone will be able to fill the void in the conservative movement that Limbaugh left? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Nicole Hemmer is a political historian at Columbia University who wrote Messengers of the Right, Conservative Media, and the Transformation of American Politics. Nikki, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me.
Prominent conservative media that we have today, it didn't exist when Rush Limbaugh's show became nationally syndicated back in 1988. How did he pave the way for the conservative media that we have now?
So one of the things that Rush Limbaugh did was he found a way to make conservative media both very popular and very profitable. So there had been like conservative magazines and little conservative radio shows, but there had never been anything like this multi-million dollar industry that he pretty much created. He had the sort of the space alone for the better part of a decade. It wasn't until 1996 that Fox News comes along. It's not really until 2000 that you start to get people like Sean Hannity and Glenn Beck who are doing the same thing on radio. And so he had this outsized influence not only on conservative media, but on the conservative movement more broadly. You know, we talk a lot today about the closeness between Fox News and the former Trump administration. Well, Rush Limbaugh had that very close relationship with conservative administrations going back to George H.W. Bush in 1992.
What was it about Rush Limbaugh that was different than other media personalities beyond being able to make money off of talking about these things?
So he pioneered a kind of political entertainment that would become one of the most central ways that people, not only conservatives, but people throughout the U.S. consume politics. He was somebody who came from a disc jockey background. So he had been in a non-political space for a long time before coming over to become a political commentator. And then he was also a pretty conservative commentator in a shock jock politics kind of way. And that was something that was pretty new and people responded to. They didn't necessarily love him. A lot of people were pretty angered by what he said, not only because it was so brash and so rude, but it was racist and sexist and homophobic. And that strong reaction would increase his popularity and would be sort of the platform that he built on over the course of his 32-year career.
And that perspective that included racism and sexism, that was something that it's not like that's how he spoke in the 90s and then he changed his tone by any means. I mean, this was how he communicated until he was done broadcasting when he died.
Yeah, I mean, people often talk about this as though it is a feature of his early show that he changed from. But I mean, just look at Rush Limbaugh during the Obama years. You know, he played this song at the beginning of his show in 2008 and 2009, this satirical song called Barack the Magic Negro. He was involved in a controversy in 2012 where he called a young woman who had testified for contraceptive access a pretty derogatory name and demanded that she release a sex tape to pay the American people back for paying for her contraception. So he had been in that mode of political rhetoric throughout his career.
Mm-hmm. Nikki Hemmer is a political historian at Columbia University who wrote a book about conservative media and American politics. And we're talking about the legacy of Rush Limbaugh and what the connection is now between the conservative politicians and political movement and the people who believe in these ideals and the media that feeds them. You can join us at 800-642-1234. What do you remember about Limbaugh, or do you listen to conservative talk radio now? Do you think that this is a marketplace of ideas, or do you think that Limbaugh and conservative radio have further polarized our country for the worse? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. You can also use the email address. It's ideas@WPR.org. Since Limbaugh began his national show in the 80s, we've seen that rise of digital media platforms. Nikki, what do you see as the driving force in today's conservative media? Because it's not as straightforward as it used to be.
That's right. Like I said earlier, when Rush Limbaugh came on the scene, not only had he pioneered a new form of radio programming, he helps to breathe new life into the AM dial, which had been kind of dying on the vine in the 1970s. He not only does that, but he creates this new right-wing media industry. And we've seen that flourish and fracture in so many ways over the past three decades. So it's cable news now, not just Fox News, but Newsmax and OAN. There are now tons of podcasts in addition to all of these terrestrial and satellite radio shows. And of course, the digital space for conservative media and right-wing media has grown exponentially over the past 15 years. And so where Limbaugh sort of had a sole voice for the better part of a decade, now there are so many competitors. There are so many places that people can look for their particular variety of right-wing media consumption. So finding the host who most speak to their ideas, to their emotions, finding the sites that most reflect their worldview, there now is just kind of endless product for people to consume depending on what they're looking for.
Endless product, but also seemingly endless personalities. We see more people trying to be, the next Rush Limbaugh. Do you recognize any media figures that you think could create that stature for themselves in conservative media?
So I don't think so, at least at this moment. There certainly are right-wing media personalities who loom large in American culture. Sean Hannity had this big moment during the Trump administration because of his closeness to the president. A lot of people are talking about Tucker Carlson as somebody who might have a crossover career in American politics. But precisely because there are so many, it's really difficult for any one voice to break through for long. So if you look over the course of the past 10 to 15 years, there are people who have moments. Like Glenn Beck was somebody that got a lot of press during the early Tea Party years as the person who sort of most channeled that particular energy within the conservative movement. But, by 2011 or 2012, he kind of flames out and then doesn't get as much attention anymore. Somebody like Ben Shapiro has gotten a lot of attention because he's younger, because he's in the podcasting space, because his politics are a little different version of right-wing politics. But he, too, will soon be eclipsed by whoever the latest big thing is. So it's very difficult in a crowded market for one person to have the kind of commanding presence that Limbaugh did when he had the whole market to himself.
Nikki Hemmer is a political historian. She stays with us as we talk about the influence of the late Rush Limbaugh and the influence conservative media have on American politics. I'm Keely Boltina, and there's room for you in our conversation. Do you think Donald Trump would have been elected president without the influence that Rush Limbaugh has on our culture? Do you think anyone will be able to fill the void in the conservative movement that Limbaugh left? 800-642-1234 as we have this discussion, or you can email ideas@WPR.org. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Thanks for being with us on The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina. It's probably been 25 years now, but I can remember this snapshot in time. It was a cold evening in the winter when you're extra aware that the sun goes down too early. I was riding in the car with my family, pulling up to the grocery store we called Verge's, because it's a small town and Verge owned the grocery store. It's stuffy in my winter gear with the heat running, and I can hear Rush Limbaugh's voice streaming through the radio. I had no real understanding of what he was talking about or who he was. But that mundane moment that happened countless times growing up, it's crystal clear in my mind even now. That's what conservative talk radio is for people across the country. It's part of everyday life. So was Limbaugh, right up until he died of cancer. And we're talking about conservative media with Nikki Hemmer. She's a political historian at Columbia University who specializes in media, conservatism, and the far right. And Nikki, help us understand the place in people's lives that conservative media, and specifically Rush Limbaugh, has found.
So he's been so important to the political identity of a generation, if not more, of conservatives. He really was somebody who had a loyal following, so much so that, you know, in those early days, there were these things at restaurants called Rush Rooms, which during the period in which his show was airing, the restaurant would just set aside a room and play Rush Limbaugh and let people listen together with their friends. Listeners to the show called themselves Ditto Heads because they would come on air and just agree with everything that Rush Limbaugh had just said. And you have heard this in the outpouring from conservatives in the last week or so, that there was a real emotional connection. And that emotional connection is driven not just by the habit of listening to him, but the medium of radio itself, right? There's a real intimacy to just hearing someone, and in the case of Rush Limbaugh, being able potentially to talk back to them through being able to call into the show. So there was a way in which he really bonded with his audience that created an affection and a set of political identities that have had a real power in American politics.
John from Clear Lake called, couldn't stay with us. John said that they occasionally listened to Rush Limbaugh, found him to be inaccurate and divisive, especially as he recently implied that people who have leftist views are bad people. And Rush's rise, it did coincide with an increase in misinformation and conspiracy theories. Nikki, how much is he responsible for that?
He's hugely responsible. It didn't just coincide with the rise of Rush Limbaugh, but Rush Limbaugh was a real driver of polarization and misinformation. I mean, during the Clinton years, he spread conspiracies about the Clintons having killed their close friend, Vince Foster, who had died by suicide. This anti-liberalism that the caller talks about, like sort of a reflexive, not just opposition, but real demeaning of liberals. There is not an attempt here to find a common ground. It is a show that is very much rooted in an us versus them identity. And that's really important because, you know, he's coming off of the Reagan administration. And I think that we could certainly argue that the Reagan administration was divisive, but Reagan himself was someone who liked to present himself as someone bringing together people, bringing Democrats into the Republican Party. And Limbaugh comes out with a much more negative, polarizing, kind of partisan approach to politics. And that's something we would see reflected in everyone from Newt Gingrich to Donald Trump.
Nikki Hemmer is a political historian at Columbia University, and we're talking about conservative media and politics. You still have time to join in if you call at 800-642-1234. That number again is 800-642-1234. Nikki, today marks the start of the annual Conservative Political Action Conference known as CPAC. And as we talk about political figures and political events, help us understand what this conference is.
So CPAC has been around for decades now. I think it got its start in the 1970s. And it's this annual convening of conservatives from around the country and a really great snapshot of where the conservative movement is at any given point in time. And I think this year, you know, it's flying under the banner of America Uncanceled. So there will be a real focus on what the right and others call cancel culture. So a real culture wars feel to it. It will be the first major appearance by Donald Trump since leaving the presidency. And it's also a good way to see where divisions in the party are as far as who's included and who's not. So you're not going to see, certainly not going to see any anti-Trump Republicans at this year's CPAC. They would not be invited.
Rush Limbaugh's been intimately linked to the Republican Party. He was named by the GOP an honorary member of Congress in 1994. His speech at CPAC in 2009 is cited all over the place even now. So what influences can we still expect to see at CPAC that really came from Limbaugh?
We will definitely see tributes to Limbaugh throughout this CPAC conference. But also, I think that 2009 speech is really important because he built on the theme that he wanted Barack Obama to fail. In years where there is a Democratic president, Rush Limbaugh was often pointed to as the leader of the opposition, the leader of the Republican Party. And so one of the things that we're going to see is who is that voice now? I mean, Donald Trump is obviously going to be the main contender for leader of the opposition going forward. But are there other people? And how are they talking about resistance to the Joe Biden presidency and opposition to the Joe Biden presidency? Because that kind of implacable opposition we saw during the Obama years was something that was shored up through conservative media throughout those years. And so we're likely to see some of the arguments about the Biden administration that we'll hear over the next 4 years being developed and being propagated at CPAC this year.
What are you expecting to hear from President Trump?
This is going to be a fascinating speech precisely because I don't think in the last 5 years we've had this long of a period that we've gone without hearing from Donald Trump. I expect that we will hear something about his plans for 2024. I think we will hear him sort of reasserting his position of leadership within the Republican Party and within the American right. And beyond that, it's hard to say exactly whether he will sound any different from what he sounded like prior to January 6th. I mean, one of the things that was true of the Trump presidency is people were always predicting that he was going to change in some fundamental way because of outside events. And of course, he never did. So I think we'll hear President Trump, former President Trump, as he always was.
As we talk about the conservative politics related to conservative media and Rush Limbaugh, we've got Marty from Eau Claire who's ready to join the conversation. Good morning, Marty.
Good morning. Yes, I was just I was listening and I was just appreciate your mentioning Rush Limbaugh because he's really not been even heard on the media about the loss that the conservative movement has in his life, his legacy. And I appreciated that. But then immediately there was a comment about his disseminating misinformation. And I was just really disappointed that here you went from a person who made an influence on millions and millions of people. And immediately you're calling him a liar and an agent of misinformation.
Yeah, Marty, I'm going to jump in here because I certainly want to clarify that because there's a big difference between news outlets and reporting facts and truth and spreading conspiracy theories, which Nikki Rush Limbaugh did.
He absolutely did. And especially in the past year, this has been an important part of his program, whether it was misinformation about the results of the 2020 election or about the pandemic. I mean, it's important to understand that, yes, there was a deep affection between Rush Limbaugh and his audience, but he was not somebody who felt constrained by the norms of journalism. And he was somebody who, as part of the conservative political apparatus, fed into much of the misinformation that we heard from President Trump as well.
And how do we begin to understand what the effect of misinformation, which is untruths told specifically to lead people astray from the facts, how do we gauge what effect that's actually had on the United States?
Well, I mean, one place that we can see it quite visibly, and people have talked about this a lot, has been in the insurrection at the Capitol on January 6th. I mean, this was a violent moment that was constructed entirely on misinformation about the 2020 election and the idea that the 2020 election had been interfered with, that it had been stolen, that it was fraudulent. And it was that, what's been called the big lie, and I think appropriately so, that fueled that violent day. And so that's a very precise way. Of course, we can see it in all sorts of ways. People who still believe that Barack Obama was not born in the United States, this idea that the resistance to wearing masks during the pandemic. I mean, there are some very real and deadly effects to misinformation that have become very, very clear over the past year.
And we won't know the full extent of them for a long time.
That's exactly right. I mean, this is something that has become so corrosive to American democracy and to liberal democracy more broadly in a way that is really damaging in acute ways that we have seen. But if you think about the long-term erosion to democracy, this is something that we will be dealing with for generations.
Nikki, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Nicole Hemmer is a political historian at Columbia University who specializes in media, conservatism, and the far right. Hemmer's author of Messengers of the Right, Conservative Media and the Transformation of American Politics, that was published by Penn Press in 2016. Up next is news. Then we talk with a pediatrician who found that schools were not a major point of transmission for the coronavirus in the central Wisconsin area. We're talking about that study. I'm Keeley Boltina. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keeley Boltina, in for Kater Jerkent. What if you call 911 and no one comes? That's a problem facing several towns in northern Wisconsin after they lost their ambulance service provider at the beginning of this year. Towns are mandated to provide emergency services unless they're offered elsewhere. But as Danielle Kading reports, rural communities are struggling to provide that service because of a lack of volunteers, long distances, and inadequate financing.
Bud Rubeck never saw him coming. He and his wife Julie had gone over to a neighbor's house late one night in Clam Lake to try to smooth things over between a fighting couple. Instead, the man blindsided him, punching Rubeck on the left side of his head. He fell and hit the ground hard.
When the ambulance service got here, had we not had critical care paramedics, I would have been dead.
Great Divide Ambulance Service and Cable was there to respond when his life was on the line. Paramedics took him to Cable, where they were met by a helicopter. He was flown to a hospital in Duluth, where he spent several days on life support. He left after a month and had to learn to walk all over again. But now if someone dials 911 in Clam Lake, he says there's no guarantee anyone will answer.
We're on our own.
Clam Lake recently lost its ambulance service after Great Divide decided not to renew contracts with six towns in Ashland County. Some have found service, but several others have not. Great Divide's Rob Poles says the ambulance service struggled with overtime costs and other mounting expenses, but the biggest issue was staffing.
And in a pandemic situation, there aren't people lining up to be first responders right now.
The town of Gordon is one of the places left in the lurch. Chairman Doug Thorpe asked every surrounding agency if they would contract to respond, but they all pointed to a lack of staff or the distance. It could take some up to 45 minutes to respond one way.
That just leaves us kind of in the middle of the woods with no ambulance service.
While services like Great Divide pay staff, more than 90% of Wisconsin fire departments rely on volunteers like Mellon Fire and Rescue. The fire and ambulance outfit is nearby towns that lost service. But Fire Chief Tony Huber says they may not be able to answer every call because they have a small staff of just under a dozen volunteers.
The younger generation does not want to do this stuff. You look up here in northern Wisconsin, there's not a lot of younger people sticking around, for one thing.
Like many rural areas, northern Wisconsin has a shrinking and aging population that makes it difficult to find volunteers. Gordon and other towns reached out to the Ashland Fire Department last fall. Ashland has the closest service with a paid staff.
Most of them are gone right now. We have had a terribly busy day today.
That's Fire Chief David Wegener. On the day we meet up, he says they had five calls in about 20 minutes. One ambulance was just returning from transferring a patient to the hospital. Wegener says they have to weigh their call volume and staffing when they get requests to provide service. He says they're now responding to one nearby town that lost service, but that doesn't make sense for communities farther away.
And when you take into account weather conditions and the roads and such, not only does that place the patient at risk, but it places our staff at risk as well.
Long distances increase the need for highly skilled staff that can provide critical care in the field. But Thorpe and Huber say the necessary training and testing are barriers for volunteers. They think the state should ease a testing requirement for first responders to get certified. Republican lawmakers have reintroduced a bill to do just that. But John Ike, who directs the Wisconsin Office of Rural Health, fears that pits the need for volunteers against patient care.
People are only doing this because they're feeling desperate. And this is why we need to address this with more serious solutions.
Ike and others think state or local governments should pay people to respond rather than relying on volunteers. But town officials argue their ability to raise revenue is limited. Bud Rubeck doesn't know the best solution, but he hopes to see one soon as the COVID-19 virus remains a risk for older residents.
With everything that's going on, I just think it's important that we get this figured out
before the next time someone dials 911. Daniel Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to The Morning Show. The coronavirus that causes COVID-19 emerged just more than a year ago, and scientists are working furiously to help us understand what its existence means for our communities long term. An issue impossible to avoid in its effect is education. We're talking with a doctor whose research is cited by the CDC as it pushes out information about safely opening schools to in-person learning without worsening a devastating and deadly pandemic. What questions do you have? Call 800-642-1234. What are you wondering about children or asymptomatic spread of COVID-19? What have you experienced? Do you have a child who's gone back to school? Do you have one who is still learning remotely? What do you see and what do you wonder? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. Our guest is Dr. Amy Falk. She's a pediatrician at Aspirus Doctors Clinic in Wisconsin Rapids. Dr. Falk, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Certainly. You released a study at the end of January, which was published by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, that found encouraging results when it came to COVID-19 spread in schools in the central Wisconsin area. What did you find?
We were, so I've been involved with the school districts here in Southwood County since the beginning of the early planning stages in the summer 2020, as most of the schools here wanted to go back in person in some capacity. And I was just a consultative role to help them, guide them in the best evidence-based way possible. And when we were sort of watching masking compliance as school went on, as well as the case rates, we found that there was despite really rampant community spread we had here in Southwood County at that time, we really found over the 13 weeks that there was very minimal cases of COVID-19 in the schools. We found 191 cases between students and staff during the 13-week time frame. And of those, only 7 cases were thought to be contracted within the school. And all of those were students. There was no teachers who, based on contact tracing, were thought to have contracted COVID-19 in the school setting.
Which is interesting because earlier this week, the CDC put out information citing a study in elementary schools in Georgia where mask use and social distancing were sometimes inadequate. And that points to the idea that teachers may play an important role in the transmission of COVID-19 in schools. What do you make of that?
Yeah, and I think that echoes pretty well what we've kind of discovered over the past couple of months. There's been some other studies released, including a very large study looking at how well people of different age groups transmit COVID-19. And it seems that children between the ages of 0 to 19 really don't transmit the virus to many people. Like on a large scale, they just really aren't responsible for significant spread. They're not super spreaders. The age group that does that is generally like 20 to 50 is what they had cited. And so I think that points to the fact that adults really do seem to drive this. And if teachers really take on really great masking and distancing the best that they are able, the students really don't seem to be a source of infection, unlike many other viruses that we know. As a pediatrician, we know that there are many types of viruses that are that children do propagate quite readily, and this just doesn't seem to be one of them.
So when you're looking at your numbers and other studies, what is the real takeaway from that low transmission rate after you analyze the data?
I think it's important to recognize, I mean, every school system is very different. Every community, I think, in a mental place is in a very different place. But what we found echoes what Duke found with a very large study in other places around the country and the world, that schools are really a safe place to be with with mitigation measures such as masking, distancing really wasn't perfect at these schools. We didn't publish that data, but it really was quite variable as far as what students and staff were maintaining. And I think it just shows that with appropriate mitigation measures like hand washing and masking and some level of distancing, that that schools really are a safe and important place for children to be.
We're talking with Dr. Amy Falk, who's a pediatrician in Wisconsin, and we're talking about a study she did about transmission of COVID-19 in schools and the broader picture here with the doctor. And we've got Ethan in Madison who gave us a call. Hi, Ethan.
Hi. Yeah, I was just curious if in your study you looked at infections of people within the students' homes and whether or not you were regularly testing students or just waiting until they're symptomatic to go to the testing route.
Ethan, thanks for both of those questions. Let's start with the first one, and that's how are you contact tracing and figuring out if students got the virus from home or someplace else, and how can you confirm or deny that it happened through school?
And yeah, that's a great limitation of our, that's a big limitation of our study and many other studies during the time frame that, you know, from end of August, beginning of September through November, testing capacity was really not there in many settings. And so it really relied on school administrators, teachers, and public health department contact tracing. So that's just obviously extensive questioning, trying to figure out where the kid was. And through their investigations, as was occurring in much of the country at that time, that these cases, the other cases, aside from the seven that were thought to have occurred within the school, were traced back in some way to either an adult household contact who had COVID-19 prior that fit the kind of the window of infection, or some other activities such as extracurriculars. And so regarding your point on asymptomatic surveillance, no, that was not being done during that time frame. But we are, I am helping the schools initiate asymptomatic surveillance that actually started on Monday here at our middle and high school, the large middle and high school in Wisconsin Rapids. And so we will be hopefully surveilling approximately 20% of the student and staff body based on volunteers and just to see what the asymptomatic rate is in the school. I think a lot of people fear that the asymptomatic rate is high, but there's some really good postulations that perhaps it is not a high number and you would expect to see more symptomatic people in those age ranges. So we'll see what that shows.
We've had many doctors on the Ideas Network come on and say asymptomatic spread is absolutely a driving factor in the spread of COVID-19. I just want to make sure I understand what you're saying. Are you saying specifically that asymptomatic spread might be less likely in a certain range of schools? Are you saying it's less likely than we have believed so far?
I think so. Asymptomatic spread is thought to be a major driver, but my point was in the school setting, one would expect that if there was a large asymptomatic rate, you would expect more symptomatic people, especially in a school setting where people are closer together, perhaps than out in the community with, you know, kind of more contact there in some cases. And so I think and that's just not been well described. And so that's what we're hoping to get at based on, you know, the asymptomatic rate. We've done testing for several days, and right now we've found zero asymptomatic cases. And obviously, that's 2 days of data. So it's going to take a few weeks for us to figure out what's going on in that capacity. But again, there's not robust data on that within the school setting specifically.
Dr. Amy Falk released a study that found very low coronavirus transmission rates within 17 schools in central Wisconsin. We're talking about what that means and what the limits are of case studies like this, especially right now. Still time for you at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about how schools and students and teachers can hold in-person classes safely? What mitigation measures do you see happening in your districts that you think are working or maybe not? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Send an email to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Keely Boltina. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. National health experts say schools can be safe places for students to learn despite a pandemic. A study out of Wisconsin indicates things like mask wearing in schools created an environment that didn't spawn as many symptomatic cases of COVID-19 as were spreading in the community. It's one piece of science that we're using to understand what we should do next as the coronavirus remains a threat. We're talking about this with the doctor who ran the study here on The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina. Our guest is Dr. Amy Falk. And here on the Ideas Network, we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. We've got Julie in Wisconsin Dells ready to talk with us. Hey, Julie.
Hello. Yes, I'd like to know if the tests were done equally in grade schools and in high schools, because high school students, many of them work jobs like in restaurants and things like that, so they are out in the community more. And I also know of cases of special ed students who won't wear or can't wear masks that their parents continue to take them into school even though they're sick. Teachers have gotten COVID from them and given it to family members, and they have lost their family members. They've lost their spouses. So it can get spread in schools. And I'm just wondering, are you testing including more high schools in this study?
Julie, thanks for that question. Dr. Falk.
We had a large population of secondary schools. There were nine in total. And we, again, we were not doing any testing. We were just following the school's report of cases and cases that were thought to be spread in schools. And the any student, according to, you know, kind of the guidelines for each of the districts involved, were excluding any student with any symptom. And they were sent home from school. Some of the schools did have some testing capacity that they were able to swab the students prior to leaving for home, but they would either need to isolate for the 10 days or get tested and show a negative result if it was some other infection. And so, yes, there was equal testing that way. The special ed population is a different population. Interestingly, our study, none of the cases that were contracted within the school involved any of the special ed populations, where obviously there are some difficulties with masking, perhaps. I know in those classrooms, a lot of times teachers in our area are wearing, you know, surgical masks and face shields and other types of protective devices that perhaps, you know, kind of traditional classroom teachers are not doing. And so obviously that varies significantly by school. But yes, students were excluded in the same rate at both high school and elementary schools. And again, of our seven cases, five were contracted in elementary schools among elementary students and only two in secondary schools. So we did see less there.
The guidelines from the CDC don't unequivocally say school is safe, just send kids, everything will be fine. It requires layers of work to try to keep kids and all of the staff members safe. What do we need, based on the data that you've seen, Dr. Falk, what do we need in schools to make sure that they do remain places where COVID doesn't spread as much?
I think the most important thing is masking, physical distancing to some extent. There's been a much debate on the national level whether 6 feet is needed in the classroom setting. And again, we're going to be looking at that as we bring secondary students back into a full population in the next several weeks, but just to be able to get kids back and out of a hybrid situation. But I think distancing to some degree, masking for sure, proper masking over mouth and nose, and working with children and grownups for that matter to be able to do that. A lot of schools have some level of increased ventilation, whether that's just running the HVAC system for a few hours before and after the school day. And obviously hand hygiene is essential for the mitigation of any virus, especially the coronavirus as well. So I think making sure those things are in place, as well as a really good network of people who are able to help contact trace and help with a lot of the data collection, because I think that's one of the hardest parts for schools as I've worked with them, is just the coordination and logistics of kind of keeping all these moving parts and keeping track of all of them.
Dr. Amy Falk is a pediatrician at Aspirus Doctors Clinic in Wisconsin Rapids, and she's been studying coronavirus transmission rates in schools. We're talking with her here on the Ideas Network, and William in La Crosse is ready to talk with us. Hi, William.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on. This is such a great show, and I'm so thankful to have this researcher on. And we have had our rural school here in person all year long, and I think it's just so important for the kids And it's good to hear this research that is bearing out what we've seen locally. And I just wonder, with, you know, you were suggesting, Amy, that the masks are so important, and I could see how that would be the case, except in, you know, when the kids are there for 6 hours long, and then, you know, they're touching the masks, they're, you know, the masks are falling down, they're coughing into the masks, they're taking the masks off for snacks and meals and such. It just seems like, do they really need a mask? In, you know, your research has shown that they're not spreading it. And I don't know. I find, from what I hear in the schools from people that work there, it doesn't seem like the masks are really making that much of a difference. I'd love to hear why you think they're so important.
Yeah, William, thanks for the question. Dr. Falk.
I think masking, and this is echoed not just in our, you know, relatively small drop in the bucket study regarding the abundant literature of the importance of masking. Interestingly, you know, masking, we got to remember, is just a physical mechanical barrier between your mouth and nose and the environment. And so, yes, if kids are touching their face and if their hands are contaminated, they might inoculate themselves. That's obviously not going to be protective for them. There is some level of protection that a mask gives each person regarding different, you know, basically droplets won't go into your mouth and nose from the environment in such a fashion. And so I think it is important, until we learn more about how children transmit this, you know, to what degree they do, that we continue to have them cover their mouth and nose. I have three children, and so I know kids are wonderful maskers. They really are. And we asked a lot of them in the school day to wear a mask all day. But our schools here, for example, in the elementary groups, they're not masking at recess when they're outside. And so they are getting those breaks throughout the day. And my kids really haven't complained a whole lot about that. And obviously, I'm sure it's not perfect, but we do know that it has been at least helpful based on our results and many others.
What about things that we talk about that are just issues in regular education that seem to translate? I'm thinking things like class sizes. I mean, does it change the safety of a situation if you have 25 kids in a class versus 15? What about on-off days, or keeping cohorts of teachers and students together so that if infection spreads there, it stays there? What are other things schools need to think about from the health perspective?
That's a really great point. And many of the elementary schools here are cohorted. For example, a class, you know, a first grade class does not intermix with other first grade students or other students or teachers. And then if one student gets infected, they all go out. But I think more is to be learned about the role of distancing within the classroom. I think it is important for schools to, and many schools are doing this, even when distancing is not possible to 6 feet, they will know via assigned seating or other ways to kind of keep track of children and teachers who's close to whom, and then using that to contact trace. For example, Ohio, Missouri, other states are no longer requiring quarantines if you have a close contact within the classroom setting. And so just obviously they're monitoring that very carefully. But I think overall, we will likely be learning more about the role that distancing has in the classroom. And I think a lot of people in the country and also internationally are postulating that distancing, especially with perfect mask wearing, is not going to be the essential mitigation measure.
Dr. Falk, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Dr. Amy Falk is a pediatrician at Aspirus Doctors Clinic in Wisconsin Rapids. Jill from Kimberly called, said she teaches kindergarten and her kids wear masks well, and they don't have a problem with it. So that's another perspective there wanted to work in. Just ahead is the news. Then we take a deep dive into what education officials say they need to reopen their different school districts around the state. I'm Keeley Boltina. Stay with us here on The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.